the Value of an American Watershed is being shown on Tuesday, 7 p.m. at Arena Theater in Point Arena. An opportunity to make a difference in our community is being offered at the Fort Bragg Public Library. Hospice volunteer training takes place April 15th through May 27th on Wednesdays from 1 to 4 p.m. The Society for Creative Anachronism is an international not-for-profit living history organization dedicated to bringing the Middle Ages and Renaissance to life through research and recreation. The local group, the Shire of Ravenshore, meets at Wowzer in Willits every Wednesday from 6 to 8 p.m. Everyone welcome. Minors need to be accompanied by a parent or guardian. Good care of trees in our neighborhood is the subject at the California Native Plant Society meeting on Thursday, 7 p.m., 1203 West Clay Street in Ukiah. The Now and Then film series presents a fundraiser for Love and Mama Farms on Thursday, 7 p.m. at the Willits Little Lake Grange. The biopic, Temple Grandin, will be shown. Friday is Cherish Youth Day at the City of 10,000 Buddhas in Talmadge, with educational booths from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m., and at 11 a.m., children perform an epic play with dancing and music. Lunch is provided. The Mendocino County Library Advisory Board is seeking representatives from the City of Willits and the First District, which is Potter Valley, Redwood Valley, and Talmadge. The volunteer board helps guide library policy, reviews budget, and interfaces with city and county government. More information with Mark Comer, 459-2775. And performance poet Kirk Lumpkin is the featured poet in Point Arena on Thursday, 7:30 p.m. at 215 Main Street. Please submit your public service announcement at least 2 weeks in advance. And check out our complete events calendar at kzyx.org.
Good evening. You are tuned to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio. We also stream on the web at kzyx.org. Good evening, and welcome to the April edition of the Agriculture and Ecology Hour. I'm your host, Doug Mosel, bringing you an interview this evening with David Oyen of Timeless Seeds, Timeless Food. Support for the Agriculture and Ecology Hour this evening comes from our members and the Solar Living Center. Real Goods Earth Day celebration is Saturday, April 18th at the Solar Living Center in Hopland. Live music, demonstrations and workshops, plus rescued raptors, the Observation Beehive, and wine tastings from Fry Vineyards. April 18th, a day to get inspired, educated, and entertained. Open to all. Information at realgoods.com. So, folks, you have a treat in store for you this evening. I'm very happy to have on the line with me from the late night hour of 10 p.m. in Washington, D.C., David Oyen of Timeless Seeds. David and other farmers are the focal points of a fine new book called Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America by Liz Carlisle. David and his company, Timeless Seeds, have been one of my treasured sources of lentil and barley seeds over the years. And I recently had the opportunity to visit Dave's home base of operations in Ohm, Montana, south of Great Falls. Beautiful, beautiful country. I just wanted to stay there. There, as I walked in to have a conversation with his plant manager, there on the table was the book about which I'd heard so much already, Lentil Underground. And, of course, I snapped up a copy. And, Dave, I have to tell you that I have to confess that it's the first book that when I finish this last chapter or so, will be the first book in a long while I've read cover to cover. Liz is a fine writer, and the story she tells of your work in the world and of Timeless Seeds over these last, 35 or 40 years, is really, really well done. And the story for me has been one of inspiration and insight and encouragement when the road is a little rough, worrying about my own grain farming and my difficulty with lentil production here in Northern California. So with that lengthy introduction, too long, Dave, welcome, and thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Doug. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well,
look forward to the conversation.
Good. I'm excited about this conversation, and I'm imagining that you may be a little tired of talking. You're well into a book tour that's taken you from California all across now to the eastern part of the U.S., and will, I think, in a month or two bring you back to California, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. You know, Doug, I guess I never get tired of talking about organic farming and lentils and having, you know, conversation with people who are doing their own thing in support of a more sustainable agriculture and a more environmentally friendly food system. And that's one of the real pleasures of this book tour. It's been going on since the 1st of February. And as you've indicated, we visited many, many locations, and in all it'll be something in the neighborhood of 40 or 50 college campuses. But I just have to report to you, and it was kind of a surprise to me in a sense, I guess, is all the activity that is going on out there, you know, in campus, on campuses, the ecology programs, the agroecology programs, food systems programs, and the student organizations and the professors that are very much engaged in this topic.
A little different from the from your early beginnings when it was difficult to find researchers at the university level having any interest in anything but what is sometimes in the book referred to as chemical rather than conventional agriculture.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of good things have happened in the last 30 years, basically. I'm a third generation Montana farmer. My grandparents emigrated from Norway and homesteaded on the prairies of central Montana. And, you know, my folks lived through the Dust Bowl days. And I moved back to the farm in 1976. And in lots of ways, you know, our family kind of, you know, represents the transition to industrialized agriculture and now hopefully the transition away from it. It's, you know, it's kind of been a century of journey, I guess, you know, for my family. And as you indicate, you know, back in the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s, there really was, you know, not very much support at the, you know, at the land-grant universities and with, you know, researchers and extension agents and so forth, or the neighbors, of course, because everyone was pretty much locked into this, you know, the industrial kind of chemically dependent agriculture that we're all very familiar with still.
Very much so. And I really want to go on with your story a little bit. But before we do that, I want to ask you to give us a little bit of a flavor of the reception you've had in these, what did you say, 40 or 50 campuses and a number of other hosting groups. Give us a sense of how people have responded to your story.
Now, you know, we've had a great reception at every, you know, at every stop. And I think, you know, people appreciate a bit of historical perspective on, you know, what has brought us to you know, where we are today, you know, and the interest in the food system and so forth. And part of the story that I always tell is that when I moved back to the family farm in 1976, you know, I wasn't thinking in terms of food system per se. You know, I was a farm kid moving back to the farm, interested in converting that farm to certified organic production and producing organic crops. And of course, you know, what I've learned in the decades since is that the food system is a lot bigger than just the farmers. And I think we're seeing that on the campuses, you know, even urban campuses. We were at City University, New York, just yesterday. I'm in a very urban camp. I wouldn't even call it a campus. It was a high-rise. It was a high-rise building.
Right.
And yet, you know, and yet the room was filled with people, both with students, but also people from the community, who, you know, even right there in Midtown Manhattan, were very concerned and very engaged in you know, changing the food system to be more healthy for the planet and more healthy for the people who eat the food.
So you returned to your family farm after being out in the wide world. In reading this, I believe you and I were in Chicago at the same time. Yep, and you were studying at the University of Chicago. And another parallel we have is that we both were theology students.
Oh, is that
a fact? Yeah, yeah. And in fact, that's what I was doing when I was in Chicago. And at one point, there's an exchange between Liz Carlisle, the author of this book, and you and Doug and Anna, in which there's a reference made to your theological background. And it's, I have to say that I picked up a slight discount of that, almost as though, not from you, almost as though it meant that you were a little soft on analysis and facts and so on. And I think because I'm so sensitive to it, and I regard my theological roots as one of the best things I have going for me, I wonder what role has that background? I mean, you ventured out seeking a black elk and studied with Brown, I think, Joseph Brown, which was the point at which you asked Liz Carlisle if she knew him because you spotted the number 4 on her tag. Back in Nebraska, all of our counties were also numbered, and so we would know, oh, yeah, he's from Antelope County. I must know him. And so you recognized immediately that she was from Missoula. And that's the point at which you said, I love this quote, come on in the house and bring that notebook with you. So talk a little bit about the role of your, if I may be so bold as to use this term, your spiritual seeking has played in your return to the land and your adventure since.
Yeah. You know, I never regret my liberal arts education and my interest and my what I've learned with my religious studies time at the at the university. I actually graduated in with religious studies and philosophy degree. And I think many of us who are involved in organic agriculture and are looking at a more environmentally responsible way to live not only our occupations but our lives, we're really driven by my sense of purpose, you know, that go beyond, you know, what it's kind of traditionally called the bottom line, you know, goes beyond the size of the bank account. And I credit my religious studies education, you know, with a good part of that.
Uh-huh.
As you noted, I did have the, you know, the great opportunity to study under the Native American scholar Joseph Epps Brown, and to learn, you know, a lot more about how the traditional culture, in that case, the Native American culture, you know, thought about the relationship of, you know, of human beings to what they call the Mother Earth, you know, and more these days we more, I guess, commonly call it, you know, the planet or ecology, but. Through that experience, you know, I really came to appreciate the value of nature and the importance of being a part of the natural world, not being, you know, above it, not being in control of it, but that there's a great wisdom in nature that if we can tap into that, you know, and understand it and apply it to not only our lives but our food system, that it just works out a lot better, you know, than attacking nature with toxic chemicals or with synthetic fertilizer, and it takes a bit of a, I guess, patience maybe, you know, is the word, because the earth is a patient teacher. You know, and I think human beings are not always patient students. You know, I often reflect that if I, in fact, did kind of the traditional route of going to a land-grant university, you know, and studying agronomy, you know, and ag business and so forth, as, you know, as a number of my my high school classmates did, I think it may very well be the case that I would have come back, you know, with a much different attitude and a much different approach to agriculture, just because agriculture science, you know, at least in those days, was really quite narrowly focused, I think, in many of the ag campuses, and sort of taught, you know, recipe agriculture, recipe farming.
Yep.
You know, you put so many pounds of nitrogen on to get such and such a yield of wheat or barley. You know, when you put so many ounces of this or that chemical, you know, your tank mix it at this and that rate to control, you know, broadleaf weeds or wild oats or whatever it is. And, you know, I guess that has some value if one's paradigm is, you know, is to control what's going on in the field and on the farm. But I'm not sure that it has, you know, real long-term value when we're looking at a more responsible approach to farming and to raising food. And of course, you know, there are exceptions to those approaches. One of which actually had a great influence on me, and that was a book written by a researcher in your neck of the woods, Miguel Altieri.
Oh, yes.
He wrote a book called Agroecology.
Yep.
You know, whereby he looks at traditional agricultural practices and cultures and asks, how can we apply these basic principles to, you know, more contemporary agriculture? And I had the good opportunity of actually introducing him at a conference that a number of us organized through the Alternative Energy Resource Organization in Montana, which by the mid-80s had become kind of the clearinghouse for what we called then alternative agriculture or organic agriculture. And we organized a conference on the campus of the of Montana State University, the land-grant university, and we invited Miguel Altieri up to give the keynote address.
Uh-huh.
It was, you know, kind of my real exposure, if you will, to someone who looked at agriculture systematically, holistically, and yet, you know, rigorously. You know, I mean, this guy is a world-renowned scientist, and so he brings both science and a more traditional wisdom, I think, you know, to his work. But I was very much inspired by what I learned from him, from what he said at that conference, and what I learned in his book, Agroecology. I've been more or less trying to apply that and understand it, you know, in practice, as well as in theory for the past 35 years.
And a bit later, I'd like to come back to an application, if you will, of the corn, beans. What's the third one in the traditional agriculture? Corn, beans, and help me with that. And pardon?
Squash.
Yes, corn, beans, and squash. There's a sort of equivalent in Lentil Underground. That's quite a story from one of the farmers. But I wanna go back for a minute now to Arrow. And I want to ask you to talk about black medic and weeds, because I want to just touch on how all of this got started for you.
Yeah.
Black medic.
Okay, black medic. Well, another inspiration for me was actually a researcher at Montana State University. You know, the subtitle of the book is, you know, Little Underground. The subtitle is Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America.
Right.
We know not only are there renegade farmers, but there are also on occasion renegade researchers, and I'm sure you know some, you know, as well as I. But those researchers who both have, you know, the wisdom and the courage and the vision to think outside of the box a little bit. And one of those researchers, in my experience, was Dr. Jim Sims. Now he's retired, but for a couple of decades was a researcher at Montana State University. And while he was working with the FAO from the United Nations organization, he worked in northern Africa, and he was exposed to a very interesting cropping system. And it was called the Australian lay system and had been introduced to some degree to farms in North Africa. And what that system involves is a continuous cover crop using a species that has the ability to reseed itself. And these in Australia are either relatives of alfalfa or clover. They are annual legumes that are managed in such a way that the crop is seeded, the legume is seeded, and in our case it was black medic, a Medicago lupulina, which is a direct cousin to alfalfa, which is also a Medicago. And so the crop is seeded, the cover crop is seeded, it's allowed to grow up and go to seed, and it produces a high content of hard seed. So that seed is allowed to basically to shell out and lie in the ground and create this seed bank in the soil that And it has a hard seed content, so it doesn't necessarily, all of it does not germinate, you know, in the first rain or the first month or the first 6 months. It has a high hard seed content, so it takes a while for that hard shell to break down. But the advantage of that is that leguminous cover crop then volunteers the following year, and a cash crop can be seeded into that medic cover. So in addition to having the hard seed content and the ability to produce its own nitrogen as a legume, it's also relatively low growing. So a person can take advantage of different plant architecture. The black medic that we were experimenting with primarily grew up to be, well, maybe 8 or 10 inches tall, and it would just create a carpet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that first year that would cover, smother the weeds, shade the ground from the sun, and preserve soil moisture just from the fact that there was this green cover on top of the what otherwise would be exposed ground. That goes to seed. The following year, the person just ignores it, goes in, you know, cultivates the ground, and in our case, we're in wheat country, and wheat or barley in that cultivated ground, well, the wheat sprouts, you know, grows maybe, you know, knee-high or waist-high, something like that, depending on your variety. And this medic regenerates itself from hard seeds, was grown as an understory in the crop year. And again, you know, produces nitrogen, covers the soil, creates all the biodiversity that it's able to do. So at harvest time, the farmer goes in with a combine, cuts off the wheat, which is, you know, a foot or more taller than the medic was, basically leaving the medic undisturbed. The medic then again goes to seed, puts more seed in the soil, creates that seed bank. So in a sense, it creates, you know, a bit of a perpetual motion green manure crop, self-regenerating green manure crop. It was a very intriguing idea, and it was an idea that had actually been developed to a very great extent and to pretty good sophistication in Australia, really ever since the 40s. And just by happenstance, they had imported hay from Europe to feed their sheep, and in the hay was this, you know, quote unquote weed.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 40s, Australian farmers started realizing that, wow, their wheat was a whole lot better after this weed was growing in there. And they started focusing, you know, research and getting much more sophisticated on how they use that in Australia, actually. And we worked with the Australian Seed Company for a number of years, and in fact trialed some of their medics up here. But in Australia, they actually have certain varieties of medic that are best suited to, you know, certain rainfall regimes, certain soil types, and so forth. They have you know, a dozen or more medics that are very targeted to specific situations. But the basic concept is always the same, just a regenerating cover crop, nitrogen cover crop, that relies on hard seed.
Now, it was this black medic, was it not, that gave rise to the name Timeless Seeds? If I have my memory correct from the book, you initially started out hoping to grow and harvest and sell black medic seed.
That's absolutely a fact. That was the genesis. That was the reason Timeless Seeds was formed by three friends and myself. Those three as well as myself, you know, mid-20s kids moving back to family farms. Hoping to convert them to certified organic production and realizing right away that one of the biggest challenges is going to be, you know, if we didn't use synthetic fertilizer, how are we going to get, you know, the quality of wheat or other grain that is a nitrogen taker? You know, you need nitrogen in order to grow most crops. Most crops don't produce their own nitrogen. And we were introduced to this concept and this crop by this researcher, Dr. Jim Sims of Montana State University. As I say, he had done previous work in North Africa, which is where he discovered this crop and this cropping rotation. He moved back to Montana and you know, brought the idea back with him and literally found this black medic growing in, you know, in the roadside.
Right.
And said, you know, it grows here already. I don't have to bring it to right here.
Right.
You know? In fact, it was a weed. It was imported from Europe. I mean, it same kind of scenario probably came over in colonial times, and hay that came in from Europe. It literally naturalized, across the entire lower 48 states over the, over the decades.
All right. Now, I'm going to ask you to make the transition here from black medic to lentils, but I'm gonna invite you to rest your voice for a moment. I have a little surprise for you, so listen in here.
Okay.
You recognize that voice?
Oh, sure. Beautiful, huh?
Yeah. No kidding. And were Liz with us, I would ask her to tell more of her story. But I want to ask you now to talk about, because our time is moving quickly here. I want to ask you, Dave, to talk about, by the way, folks, you're hearing the voice of David Oyen, Chief Executive President of Timeless Seeds, whose epic story is told in Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers, authored by the woman whose voice you just heard, Liz Carlisle. Talk a little bit about the transition from black medic to lentils.
Yeah, well, we introduced black medic, the variety was George Black Medic, in 1987, and we were, pretty passionate and I guess naive young people in the sense that we thought we had the silver bullet that was going to transform agriculture in the Northern Great Plains. This was a soil building crop that reseeded itself, the farmers only had to buy seed, you know, once or every, you know, or every so often, and could replace nitrogen fertilizer. What we discovered was that was a pretty hard sell. You know, these days, you know, meaning 2014, 2015, cover crops, you know, are really fairly widely accepted, both in conventional and organic production systems. But back then, it was you know, a unique concept. And then to have this crop that was a broadleaf and regenerated itself from seed, you know, showed up without being seeded. Like, the crop was in control. The farmer wasn't in control. The number one question we got with Black Magic always was, well, how do I get rid of it? You know? Like, that is not the question, you know.
Exactly.
How do I keep it going? but that was indicative, you know, of being locked in a paradigm, basically.
Well, and it brings up how often you and your pioneering colleagues were looked at askew, if you will, by neighboring mm-hmm. farmers because your fields were so weedy.
Exactly. Yeah, it was, it was a crop that no one was familiar with, for sure, you know, but when we kind of, you know, figured out that paradigm was going to be, you know, a challenge for a number of farmers, the fact of, you know, giving up some control, basically, we started looking at other annual legumes that would not volunteer back, okay, and lentils being one of them. Now, Montana is a very harsh environment, eastern Montana, central Montana, and a 10 to 12, 14-inch rainfall zone, you know, so a lot of crops won't grow up there, and it's, you know, especially a lot of legumes. The lentils are one that will. Lentils are one of the first crops were ever domesticated by human beings 8 to 10,000 years ago in the Fertile Crescent, also semi-arid environment. And the same professor Jim Sims, who introduced me and others to the Black Medic, also knew that these other legumes, you know, could do that too. A certain narrow band of them, lentils and peas, particularly, he thought were fairly well suited to the Montana environment. And he did research and basically proved on you know, his own plots that in fact these were viable crops. So we started using lentils as a plowdown crop, strictly, you know, as a cover crop. It had pretty much all the advantages of Medic and didn't have the disadvantages of the fact that, you know, in other farmers' minds at least, that it would volunteer back. It was still a legume, you know, it was still a broadleaf, so it would diversify the monoculture of wheat and barley that was so common across Montana. But it was a crop that farmers could control, you know, in the sense that they had the opportunity, they had the requirement to buy seed every year, you know, which most farmers think that's a good thing, curiously. But in any case, we moved from Black Medic as a soil building crop to lentils as a soil building cover crop. And then we discovered that, you know, in fact, people have been eating these lentils, you know, for not only centuries but millennia. And in fact, there are even people in the U.S. that ate them. You know, in those days, in the late 80s, early 90s, the natural food movement was kind of just starting to get its feet under it. You know, but there were some markets developing, and we did find a company, a distributor, who was interested in buying, you know, our lentils and distributing to natural food stores and buying clubs in the region. In fact, that was Mountain People's Warehouse.
Uh-huh.
At that time, was an independent distributor. Out in Auburn, California.
Yeah. Right. Now United Foods.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, you know, we started thinking of these crops not only as soil building cover crops, but also as a cash crop.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's cash crops are important for farmers, you know. I mean, every farmer has to make a living. And in a sense, that was an easier sell to farmers. The fact that this crop would not only produce its own nitrogen, would leave some nitrogen for the following crop, but this crop had a market. You know, of course, we had to create the infrastructure to actually create that market because there really was no market for lentils in Montana, and there was no infrastructure for processing or selling them, getting into the getting them into the food stream. I mean, that was really kind of, you know, the second step for Timeless. After the cover crops, as well, we need this infrastructure in order to create a market. Farmers need a market in order to grow a crop, you know, in order to get farmers interested. If the market is not already there, somebody has to create it. And we were, you know, we needed a market for the production or growing up our own farms. And really, the first 10 years of the business, that was, you know, that was the objective. Let's get our crops to market. You know, the four of us. And then as the markets built during the 90s, then, you know, we were able to find additional farmers that were interested in crop rotations, interested in leg yields, and interested in a high-value market if they decided to harvest those crops rather than plow them into the ground.
And you've had quite an array of farmers join you in this movement, if you will. And tell us a couple of farmer stories. I'm especially interested in the, well, I guess you could say conversion, the shift of a number of conventional farmers. I can't remember the name of the one who came to you basically saying, "Look, as a conventional farmer, I've gone bankrupt. I've lost my wife, and I need to try something new."
Yeah. That individual's name is Jerry Havitz.
Jerry, right?
He's actually a neighbor of mine in the sense that he only lives about 5 or 6 miles away. And, you know, that, in fact, was Jerry's story. He's a third-generation Montana farmer, as, you know, as I was. Grew up farming conventionally, and when he moved back to the farm, you know, continued to farm conventionally. But what he found out was that it was no longer economically feasible at his, you know, at his scale. His farm was, I think, 400 or 500 acres, and his dad's farm was approximately the same size. And the cost of fossil fuels started rising in the 80s and just kind of been going up ever since. The cost of synthetic fertilizer, the cost of agricultural chemicals, they all took a toll on him. And ultimately, it took a toll on his family. You know, he did get divorced, and he came very close to losing the farm. And Liz tells the tale in the book, the story in the book about how he would drive by the Oyen place and say, "Gee, you know, that guy is nuts." He moved back to farm. His dad was growing. You know, my dad was growing malt barley. You know, and kind of doing quite well at it, and here I was growing, you know, what kind of appeared to him as weeds, either the black medic or the lentils. I'm just a crop that, you know, I mean, he just didn't recognize, and you know, and nobody in the neighborhood did recognize.
And you had to talk your dad into letting you try this out on a few spare acres while he continued the barley farming.
Yeah, you know, it was a conversation, if you will, between my father and I. You know, he was gracious enough, and you know, in lots of ways, we were definitely on different paths, I guess. But Jerry sort of saw all this happening, and what drove him to organics was the fact that he was bankrupt, you know, farming conventionally, you know, and. I was still there. He was still driving by my, you know, my so-called weedy fields. And I was still there, you know, and he was afraid he was not going to be, you know, on his farm anymore. So, I mean, he came in the office and started talking, you know, and now, he will readily admit organics is why he's still farming.
Uh-huh.
You know? And now, of course, he's committed, I mean, way beyond the economic, incentive. You know, there's kind of a number of of categories, you know, that we've seen in eastern Montana. Of, you know, why do people come to organic farming? You know, in the 60s and 70s, you know, basically back in my generation, it really kind of was based on a you know, philosophical and maybe, you know, a cultural, even a political, you know, motivation. That is why we were going to do this, kind of, you know, the back to the land movement, the ecology movement started in the 60s and so forth. You know, and there are still those individuals who, you know, who go back to their family farms, who start farming for that reason. But in addition to that, you know, there are farmers who come to it for strictly economic reasons initially, as Jerry did. There are others, and another one of the farm families featured in the book converted their farm because, you know, their family was sick, you know, was suffering from an ailment that is directly related to, you know, to the exposure to farm chemicals. And then there are those who are really thinking, you know, food systems and kind of planetary systems, and realize that it's really agriculture is kind of really the nexus between, you know, between nature and, you know, and the human endeavor. And, you know, and that is where they see themselves as being the most able to have not only an interesting life, but a life that contributes to, you know, not only their family, but the community and the planet as well. And there are some organic farmers that come to it pretty much for religious reasons. You know, they want to take care of the creation, and they're very, very much religious based in their approach. One of the things that is, I think, you know, maybe a bit different than it was, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, is that our farmers now cover the entire spectrum of, you know, of politics. Really, I mean, there are some organic farmers that are really, you know, very conservative, if you will. Some even, you know, libertarians, and there are some that are, you know, kind of on the other side of the political spectrum, as well. But what binds them together is this commitment to a more responsible agriculture, being more responsible to the planet, and being more responsible to the, to the individuals who. The shoppers, the food citizens who eat their food, but are not farmers. That's been a pleasure, I guess, you know, to see the fact that this is not, you know, as President Obama said, this is not red state and blue state, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're in this, you know, we're in this together, which is pretty one of the messages of Liz's book. You know,
this must be a source, I would imagine, of deep satisfaction to you. And I want to, in our last 10 minutes here, shift directions on you just a bit, Dave. And I want to do that with just a bit of a transition reading. It'll help give listeners a flavor of Liz's writing. Toward the end of the book, she talks about browsing through the bookshelves in the Aero office, and she comes across this VHS, which was a part of a curriculum project, and she puts it in her player. I'm kind of surprised she actually had one. Oh, she converted it to DVD. I see. She says, as soon as I got home, I popped it into my laptop and hit play. The recording didn't start with Dave, but uncannily, the opening scene unfolded just a stone's throw from the current timeless plant. Ohm farmer Greg Gould looked directly into the camera, his face shaded by a plain brown ball cap on what was evidently a very sunny day, perched serenely atop loosely folded legs in the midst of his crop. The bearded farmer responded thoughtfully to his interviewer's questions. with an astonishing economy of both speech and motion. Gould's lower body remained still as he methodically traced his fingers over a buckwheat plant, demonstrating the magic of phosphorus conversion. The grainy, shadow-drenched picture and Gould's meditative voice lulled me into the reverie of a midsummer Montana afternoon. Since this footage had never been edited into curriculum, and I wasn't a sixth grader anyway, I let my focus drift. But 14 minutes in, Greg beckoned me to listen up. "There is something that we should remember today," Gould said emphatically, "even if we forget everything else." The Zen-like farmer had ditched the buckwheat plant, I noticed, and he was now caressing a handful of soil, passing it lovingly between his palms. "There are more organisms living beneath the soil than there are above it," Greg instructed. "From this life comes all the wealth of the earth. We are merely promoting a system that doesn't kill this life, but can supply us with enough food." She has captured, I think, so beautifully and profoundly the story of you and the farmers in your circle. And I'm grateful to her, as I am to you for your work. But I want to ask you, for those of us who are in another movement, the local grains movement, to talk a little bit about some lessons that might be drawn from the Lentil Underground story and experience. You're operating on, by comparison, a much larger scale, hundreds of thousands of pounds of lentils and emmer and so on. For most of us, it's thousands of pounds, or even in some cases, hundreds of pounds. I'm wondering about parallels and about lessons. If you were going to take a few minutes to highlight a few lessons that you would want to pass on to those of us who are passionate about a local grain economy, what would those pointers be?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think one of the things that we've discovered over the last 30 years is that the market is as diverse as our fields should be. And in fact, the markets are even more diverse than probably any of our fields are. And if we've learned, you know, anything, I think, over the years, it is that resilience comes from diversity. And, you know, not only diversity in the field, but diversity in the markets as well. You know, and we, over the years, and it's pointed out in the book that, you know, a time or two, Timeless and whatever specialty grain or specialty lentil it happened to be at the time, you know, was discovered by, you know, a fairly large company, you know, a chain of stores in both cases.
One that's quite well known around the country.
Yeah. Both are quite well known in California.
Both actually are quite well known in California, yes.
But in any case, you know, basically we put all our eggs in a basket.
Yeah.
We were discovered by that company, and they said, you know, we'll buy everything that you have, basically.
Uh-huh.
You know, really scrambled. We put all our energy, all our money into serving that one customer. And then for, you know, a variety of you know, corporate decision reasons, they quit ordering.
And didn't tell you they were going to.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, you know, I think, the one lesson that I would pass on to, you know, to anyone who is growing on a smaller scale, you know, is that there are markets, you know, for every scale. And a person is actually better off, you know, many times in the smaller markets than you are in the bigger markets, because it's really a sign of strength to be able, you know, to look your customer in the eye and for the customer to look the farmer in the eye, you know, and appreciate part that each, you know, of those individuals, and or maybe there's a processor or a small distributor in between, but that each of those parts play and contribute, you know, to a viable and to a sustainable food system. You know, I mean, we're facing, you know, we're facing, even in the organic markets now, I mean, we're facing a disturbing, you know, concentration of, you know, of power, concentration of markets, you know, concentration of the economy, you know, in certain segments of the organic market as well. You know, I think if we're going to build a viable economy and a viable agriculture, you know, not only for this generation, but for generations in the future, we also have to be creating, you know, a more sustainable economy and a more sustainable, you know, and personal relationships. I mean, that's really where the strength is, you know. And I totally admire and applaud, you know, the effort that you are doing, Doug, and that you're, you know, and that your colleagues are doing, because there is opportunity, you know, and increasingly there is concern and there is care among the food citizens who buy, you know, who buy food and buy it intentionally and eat it intentionally. I mean, that opportunity is there more than it, you know, more than it ever has been. And of course, there's challenges, you know. I mean, whenever a person starts a business and tries to market something, especially something new and unfamiliar, I mean, there are always those challenges, you know, to develop the market. But you know, as the I Ching says, I guess as we end the hour here, probably I'll go back to my religious studies.
All right.
The Tao Te Ching, actually, a Taoist text, teaches us that perseverance prevails. You know, it's another way of saying just don't give up. You know, if you're doing the right thing will reward you sooner or later.
I think that's a very helpful thought, and one that I will remember when we may be facing our fourth spring drought here, where where spring planted grains have difficulty producing at all. But I also will tell you on an encouraging note that I have had lentils volunteer themselves to reseed and to grow through the winter here into a lush understory with spelt, and have taken up the practice of intentionally planting lentils with small grain. So I'm continuing to learn from all of you pioneers out there in Montana, and I think the similarities in learning to grow under drought conditions, the lessons you've taken from that experience are ones we can draw on here. I smiled when I read the harvest report. I think it was the 2012 harvest report that Liz describes, talking with you about, where in spite of the drought and the fear that production would be way low, thanks to how you all were planting, you had an 80% harvest with such good quality that you were in as good shape as you had been when production levels were higher.
That's correct.
We should wrap this up, and out of respect for it now being 11 o'clock on your end of the country, David Oyen, I will thank you again, offer you my great appreciation for your work for your support of so many of us out here. Wish you well on the rest of your journey, and I hope when you show up in Berkeley next time, I'll get a chance to shake your hand.
Yeah, we will definitely get together.
All right, yep. We'll make it happen. Thanks so much for taking this time.
Okay.
Good night to you.
Good night.
So there you are, folks, an interview with David Oyen. So much more that we could have spoken of from this fine book, Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America by Liz Carlisle, published by Gotham Books.